You're with us this morning. You're sort of at the crossroads of the world. The Haiti people came back Saturday night, last night. We have some people going to Passion in Atlanta. We have some leadership gone, our interim worship pastor. He only made it a week. Now Jeff and Jenny are on a long-planned vacation. And I know what it's like to stand up to a Jenny with daughters backing her. It's just not easy, you know, not easy to stand up to a force like that. We're very grateful that Dustin led us this morning. You're low energy this morning. You're low energy. I think Donald Trump would call this a Jeb Bush service. You think? You should never go to politics, right? I want to read the text this morning from John chapter 8, verse 34 and 35 and 36. Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. A slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. And therefore, if the son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. I had preaching teacher, a professor by the name of Dr. Haddon Robinson. He was esteemed in the preaching community. In fact, Newsweek once named him one of the 12 greatest preachers living in the English-speaking world. When he would talk about preaching, however, particularly introductions, he would very frequently say, now, it's important when you stand before a crowd, whether it's in a civil crowd or a auditorium within a congregation, that you understand one basic principle. They don't want to hear you speak. Truth of the matter is that they're almost already, most of them are almost partially bored. Some of them are completely bored, and they have a very sneaking suspicion that you're just about to make it worse. And I think that that's probably true. I think that that is probably more true about a sermon about sin. I mean, when you say, I'm about to preach it to you about sin, I think probably 100 of you just say, you know, I could have stayed home and clipped coupons this morning and saved myself the trouble of being here. But a sermon about sin. I was watching Family Feud the other day, and Steve Harvey was talking. I think one of the questions was, what do you do that you shouldn't be doing during a worship service? And what should you be what would you be thinking about that you shouldn't be thinking about? Maybe something like that. And Steve Harvey's, you know, doing his comedic routine, and he said, you know, you're sitting there, and the preacher's talking, and you want to say, I get it, I'm a sinner, we're all going to hell, move on to something else. And maybe you're thinking that, oh boy, he's going to talk about sin this morning. But let me say this in the beginning, that you really can't comprehend Christianity until you comprehend why we get so serious about sin. You really don't understand the Old Testament. You certainly don't understand what Christ is doing up on the cross. Really, the notion of sin and how it affects the world and how it sort of pollutes the world, and then what God is doing in the world is really very central to the Christian faith. It would be hard to understand the Bible. It would be hard to understand the heart and mind of God if you didn't understand really what the Bible says about sin. C.S. Lewis wrote once, he said, you look at all the religions of the world. He said, you take every one. He said, the moral code of most religions is fairly the same. There are differences, he said, but most religions could sign off to the Ten Commandments, for instance. They could go that far. The moral codes don't vary all that much from religion to religion. He said, we all know that we shouldn't be lying to each other. We all know we shouldn't be cheating on our spouses. We all know that we shouldn't be erupting in anger towards each other. We know that we should be kind, and we should be doing unto others as we would have them do unto us. There is general agreement on all of that. And there's also agreement on the truth that most of the problems that we're experiencing, most of the unhappiness in our life, is a result of not doing those things. mean, if you look at the problems of the world, you look at the problems in families and lives, why are they like it? Why is this world sometimes very hard to live in? Because people lie, people cheat, people abuse, people steal, people don't do unto others as they would have others do unto them. So C.S. Lewis said, you know, we know what we should be doing in general as a universe, but we're not doing it, and we know that most of the problems we have is because we're not doing what we know we should be doing. He said, why do we do it all? The Christian notion rests in the ideal of sin. Now, I want you to see in this text, first of all, that sin defined by Jesus is more than an act that you do. It's more than things you say. It's more than things you think. It's more than things you feel. But notice, first of all, he says that sin is a power. Sin is a force. Did you see that? He said, whoever commits sin is the servant of sin. Sin isn't just things that you do, although it is things that you do. You commit sins, you say things you shouldn't say, you think things you shouldn't say, you commit acts that you shouldn't do. But Jesus says, even more than that, sin is a power that enslaves in your life. He said, whoever commits sin, whoever does sin, is a slave of sin, is a servant of sin. Now that's very much a crucial aspect of what the Bible says about sin. It's not something that you do. What you do sort of flows out of the power that it holds in your life. There's a passage in Genesis chapter 4, and it has to do with Cain and Abel. Earlier in Genesis, you have Adam and Eve. They're booted from the garden. They have two sons, at least initially, Cain and Abel. There's a sacrifice that's supposed to be made. Abel brings what is right. He brings an animal to sacrifice. Cain brings an inferior sacrifice, produce, and so his offering is rejected. Cain is sort of favored by God. Abel is favored. Cain is sort of rejected, and this makes Cain very angry. God comes to him and says, you should have done what was right. There's no partiality with me, but what you did was wrong. But Cain begins to envy his brother. He begins to have anger. And God comes to Cain and he says, why are you angry? Why are you mad at me? Why are you mad at your brother? And why is your countenance fallen? If you did well, will you not be accepted? But notice what he says, and this is an amazing passage. He says, and if you do not do well, sin lies at your door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now notice that. God comes to Cain and he says, Cain, you don't understand what's going on in your life. You're angry, you're envious, you're fed up, you think you've been cheated, you think you've been treated poorly, but Cain, those attitudes, they're a lion. They're a tiger. They are a fierce animal. They are crouching and they are going to rule over you. They are about to take you down. They're about to control you, and you have got to rise up and fight what's in your heart, because these things are going to destroy your life. They're a predator in your life. And that's what sin is. Sin isn't just something that you do. It's not something that you think. It's not something that you feel. Sin is a predator. It seeks to destroy your life. It seeks to have the rule over you. Now notice that. Jesus says again, he who does sin is the slave of sin, is the servant of sin. Now, I think that it helps. And having said it's a power, the question then is, why is it a power? And I think that it helps to update the word slave. Because I don't think we're fully conscious of slavery in our culture. The Romans were very conscientious of slavery. There were 60 million slaves. They saw them. They were around them. They understood the ideal of slavery. But we're sort of detached from the notion of slavery. But let me read it in a synonymous word that we use that we're familiar with, which I think will get the point to you much clearer. Let me plug in this word. Jesus says, most assuredly I say to you that whoever commits sin is addicted to sin. Okay? And I think that's the synonym that's important for us to hold today. Whoever commits sin is addicted to sin. The reason that sin is so powerful, the reason that it's a force, is that every sin has in it the ability to bring you into an addictive place. All sin is addictive. And we like to look at alcohol and narcotics, and we say, boy, those are addictive elements. No, listen, all sin is addictive. That's why it has the power over you. That's why you say, I'll never do that again. I'll never get angry like that again. This is the last time I'll ever look at that on the internet. I'll never hold those feelings again. I'll never think that again. And you keep going back, and you keep going back, and you keep going back, and you can't get that thing beat in your life. Why? Because all sin is addiction. Now, let me drive that home to you and in a few minutes here. And I might have lied. It might be more than a few minutes. This will take up most of the sermon. But I want to show you that all sin is addiction. It's all addiction. So let's take alcoholism, because we all know, I think, alcoholism is an addiction. Why do we say alcoholism is an addiction? Well, you look at somebody who can't control drinking. Why would we say that alcoholism is an addiction? Now, I'm not an addiction expert, but you've got at least four different things going on with alcoholism. First of all, people who get into alcoholism, essentially, not in every case, but in the vast majority of cases, they're trying to escape something. It begins with you trying to escape a situation that you don't want to confront. It begins by fleeing or from running from a situation. And so with alcoholism, again, in the vast majority of cases, what happens is, you've got a bad marriage and you don't want to face the marriage. You don't have to do what it takes to fix it. You don't want to end that marriage, but you don't want to really confront all the situations in that marriage, and so you end up going more to drink. You've got a job, and maybe it's a very difficult job, and you're working hard, but there are a lot of things on the job that you just want to escape from. So you drink. Maybe you have financial issues, and you don't want to confront your financial status, and so you're moving to drink. Usually, alcoholism is an escape from something, and then you have something else going on. Not only are you escaping, not only is that how it begins, but you have a tolerance level that sits in. The more you drink, the more you want to drink. Not only that, it takes more alcohol for you to get drunk. And so you begin to be able to drink more and more. And so you're tolerating it. You develop a tolerance of this substance. And then there's always a denial that goes on. You remember? Denial is always... it's always part of an addiction. So not only are you trying to escape from something, but you're developing a tolerance for it. You're drinking more and more and more, and you need more to get the same effect in your life. And people are telling you, you got a problem, you need to fix this problem, and you don't see the problem, or you're denying the problem. You're saying, I really don't have a problem. After all, Dean Martin drank a lot. He was just fine, and I'm fine. And so, you know, a lot of wonderful people drink, and I don't go too far. Every now and then I get drunk, but I get drunk because I'm so happy. And so I'm at a dial. And then something else happens. Not only are you escaping something, not only are you developing this tolerance and you need more and more to get the same effect, not only are you in a bit of denial about what's going on in your life, but you really hit the bottom when it becomes a self-feeding spiral. I mean, you really know you've got an addiction when you're trying to fix the problems created by your addiction with the addiction. And so, for instance, you know, your problems at work are multiplying. People don't want to work with somebody who's drinking a lot, and it's affecting the quality of your work. And now you're under a lot of pressure, and maybe they're talking about finding another place for you, like the unemployment line. And so you're having these issues that are resulting from your drinking. And how do you deal with the issues resulting from your drinking? You get drunk. Or your wife saying, you know, I can't, you come home every day from work, you sit on the couch, you watch TV, you get drunk every night. I can't live with a person like you. I'm leaving. I'm taking all of your stuff. I'm leaving you with your fishing stuff. That's it. We're taking the kids. We're going to my mother's. And so now you have this massive amount of stress caused by your alcoholism. And how do you deal with the stress caused by your alcoholism? You get drunk. So you're in a self-feeding spiral. It starts with an escape. It begins with tolerance. You need more and more to get the same effect. You're in denial. Ultimately, you're feeding the problems caused by your addiction with the addiction. And you say, well, that's a terrible place to be. Listen to me, though. All sin is like that. That's the nature of every sin. It wouldn't be a sin if it wasn't addictive. That's the power of sin. When Jesus says it's an addiction, it's slavery. It wouldn't be sin if it wasn't addictive. But it is. So think about something like anger. Why do people get mad? Why do they blow up? Why do they fume? Why is there wrath in people? Basically escapism, isn't it? I mean, your wife sits down with you and she says, we got to talk about some things you've been doing. And what do? You get mad so you don't have to talk about things you've been doing. You blow up, you leave. It's like, I don't want to talk about it. At your job, you know, they come in and say, we need to talk about your performance. And you get mad and you say, after all I've done for this company. And why? Because you don't want to talk about your performance. Anger is essentially an escape from having to face who you are, what you're doing. Anger shuts down conversations so you don't have to talk about things that you don't want to talk about. Anger is essentially an escape. Alcohol is an escape. Anger is an escape. And you develop a bit of a tolerance for anger. I mean, you know, you get mad, but the outbursts can get a lot bigger. They can get a lot badder. The anger... You know, in the beginning, anger is sort of a control thing, but anger begins to grow in your life, and it begins to consume you. And it's funny, you know, when you're a four-year-old and you get mad, you say stuff, and it's not nearly as bad as the stuff you say when you're 50 and you're really mad. See, you start crossing lines with your anger. It gets bigger, it gets worse. And you're always in denial. I mean, have you ever went up to a person and said, you are a very angry person? What do? They get mad, right? It's like, I'm denial, you know. And then it becomes a self-feeding spiral. So not only is anger sort of an escape, not only does the anger grow in your life, not only are most people who have anger issues in great denial of their anger, but it gets into a self-feeding spiral because now their anger is creating issues. Their wife doesn't maybe want to be around them. Their employees are uncomfortable working around them. And so the boss calls them in and say, you know, you're creating a hostile work environment here, and we need to talk. And what does a person with anger issues do? They're being told, your anger has created some problems in this place, in your life, in our lives. And what do? They get mad. What do? They're addressing the issues created by their anger with anger. Now that's an addiction. You're fleeing, you have tolerance, you have denial in your life, and you have this self-feeding spiral going. That's the definition of an addiction. I think something like lust, pornography. It begins with an escape. Begins with an escape from reality. People who get caught up in lust and pornography, they're escaping the real world. Maybe an unhappy marriage, maybe the fact that they really can't get anybody to go out with them, and so that's the reality, and so they're escaping into this fantasy world. It's an escape from reality, and there's always tolerance. There's always tolerance. I mean, you might start with the lingerie section of the Sears catalog, but it's not going to end there. I mean, you need more and more to get the same effect, more and more to get the same effect. It's where pornography, that's where lust takes you. There's escalation to get the same effect in your life. There's usually always denial. It's like, well, it's not that bad. I mean, I'm just a fun-loving guy, you know. There's nothing wrong with this. This is just, you know, what fun-loving guys do. And there's denial. And then there's a self-feeding spiral. There's escaping. There's the tolerance level. There's denial. I mean, listen, you got a guy, right? He's a husband. His wife catches him on the internet looking at pornography. What happens? Well, he ends up on the couch. That's what happens. Because I don't think men understand that women don't understand pornography, right? You think you're a fun-loving guy. Your wife thinks you're weird, really weird. Okay? Remember what C.S. Lewis wrote? He said, suppose you go to an island, and it's an inhabited island. They've sort of been distant. Not many people go there. You go into the restaurant, and all the people are sitting around in the restaurant, and they got this little stage, and they're all staring at the stage. As somebody takes this napkin and they're hiding a plate, and as they uncover the plate with a steak and potato on it, everybody just loses it and starts yelling and screaming, and that's wonderful. You say, this is very strange. I can understand that you would like to eat the steak. I can't understand that you would equally like to watch the steak. And I certainly couldn't understand that it would be equally stimulating for you to just watch other people eat the steak. You'd have to say, the appetite has gone awry. I can understand if you like to eat it, but watching other people eat the steak, that's really weird. People look at pornography and lust, and you may think you're a fun-loving guy, but your wife puts you on the couch for a reason. She thinks you're weird. What happens when the guy ends up on the couch in a problem created by his lust? He hits the computer at 2:00. The thing that created your problem is what you're using to help you endure this problem that you've created. It's an addiction. Take something like lying. Lying's an addiction. Why do you lie? To escape reality. You lie to escape the truth. You don't want to confront the truth. You don't want to tell the truth. If you tell the truth, maybe people will think poorly of you. If you tell the truth, people are going to give you what you want. Lying is an escape from confronting the truth. There's always a tolerance. Your lies may get small. They will grow. The web will get bigger. You're always in denial about the lies that you tell. I mean, have you ever called a person a liar and they say, you're exactly right, I'm a no-count liar? They're always in denial, even when you've got the evidence in front of them. And of course, how do people deal with it? How do liars deal with it when their lies create problems and a group of you get together and confront them about the problems their lies have created? What do? They lie about it. It's a self-feeding spiral. Think about materialism, greed. Why do people max out credit cards? Why do people just have to have and have and have and have? What are they escaping from? Boredom, maybe? Maybe their life as it presently sits. And by the way, you should never tell people you're bored, right? Because you know what it means to be bored? It means that you're so boring you bore yourself. So when somebody says, I'm bored, that means I'm such a boring person I can't even stand myself. And I have to go do something because I can't sit here. But you're escaping something. You're escaping boredom. You're escaping the monotony of your present life. And I need toys. I need glitz. I need fun stuff. Materialism is an escape. And it always grows. You'll need more and more to get the same effect. I mean, you may start with a scooter, but you're going to end on a Harley, man. I mean, you're going to need more and more and more. There's going to be this tolerance that happens. There's always going to be denial. I mean, look at a person and say, you're just a greedy materialist. See if they own it. They're not going to own it. And what happens when the bills start coming due and the stress and their materialism has caused any number of problems? What do? It's like, I got to have, I got to go buy something. I'm stressed. Where's my credit card? I got to go buy. No, the problems in your life have been created by your overspending and greed. Just stop it. Quit spending. But materialism is an addiction. Again, it starts with an escape, tolerance, denial, the self-feeding spiral. One more. Think about unforgiveness. Unforgiveness is an addiction. It's an addiction. It begins with an escape. Unforgiveness is an escape from confronting something that has happened in your life. Maybe somebody has wronged you, and instead of saying, you know what, this is not going to destroy me, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to confront this situation, I cannot spend the rest of my life wallowing in this, I can't maybe fix what goes on, but I can change what goes on from here on in, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to face the facts as they currently are. Unforgiveness is a retreat from everything that has happened. It's a retreat oftentimes into self-pity. And that's where it begins to end. That's where it is. You always have tolerance with unforgiveness. One of the traits of sin is that it always generalizes. Sin always generalizes. And that's another topic, but it's important to note here with unforgiveness because... If you won't forgive somebody, that unforgiveness generalizes and it starts to affect people other than that person. So if somebody has wronged me and they've done something hard to me, it's very hard for me to sit over here and say, I'm not going to forgive that person. I don't like that person. I'm not going to forgive them. Because what happens is over a period of time, I'll start to dislike every friend they have. I can't believe people would be a friend with a person. That person, they did such a terrible thing to me. Look at these people who are friends with them. And you'll begin to have hatred against their friends. You'll begin to hate their spouse. You'll begin to hate their kids. If you don't deal with that in your life, there is this tolerance effect where it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's oftentimes how racism happens. I mean, if you don't deal with what somebody does in you, if you're a white person and an African-American does something to you and you don't deal with that, you could end up hating the whole race and vice versa. I mean, that's because sin always generalizes. It doesn't stay put. You just can't look at a person and say, that's the only person I dislike. They've done something wrong to me and I don't like them. Now, if you don't forgive, it'll grow to their family, it'll grow to their kids, it'll grow to their acquaintances, it may even grow to the entire race that they're a part of. There's this tolerance that keeps growing and growing and growing in your life. There's always denial. There's always denial. When you sit down with a person who's having unforgiveness in their life and say, this is killing you, this is destroying you, this is terrible, it's making you difficult to be around because every conversation keeps coming back to the same issue, what happens? There's a denial that happens in their lives. And often it's a self-feeding spiral. Oftentimes, you know what? You're next on the list. I don't like you either now. And so even the people who come into their life and say, listen, the unforgiveness, this bitterness, this hatred that you've allowed to nurture in your life, you've got to do something about it. Oftentimes, if they don't, they'll end up disliking the very people who told them that. It'll spiral on them. Listen to me. All sin is addiction. It all begins with an escape. It all has a factor of tolerance in it. It all has denial affecting it. It all leads to a self-feeding spiral. And we could take every sin in the book. They're all like that. Now, the problem with many of us is that the alcoholic or the person on drugs, it's outer. They can see the addiction. But you don't see that anger has the hold on you or unforgiveness has the hold on you. Or that lust or that lying, that all those things are addictions too. You can't break free from them. They keep coming. They keep dragging you back. But you don't see it because you don't think it's an addiction. But Jesus says all sin leads to slavery. All sin has addictive power to it. Or it wouldn't be a sin. But he also says, who the Son has made free is free indeed. Amen. Sin can drag you in, but there's something stronger than the addiction. There's something stronger than your sin. It's Jesus Christ, who the Son makes free, is free indeed. Now, how does that happen? I mean, how does Jesus free you from sin? Does he zap you? Sometimes. There are people that have had addictions. There are people that have problems in their lives, and they can stand and testify, you know what? I went down and prayed, and I've never had that problem in my life since then. I went down, and the Lord took all the desire away. He just cleaned it out, and I don't have that problem. I don't have the desire. I don't go near it anymore. It's gone. It's finished. It's over. I got zapped. Praise the Lord. And you ought to pray that the Lord will zap you. Sometimes he does it. But I think there's something else, a more common way that God handles our addictions. And that is that as you begin to know Jesus Christ, he becomes the greater addiction in your life. Okay. Some of you are old enough to remember Uncle Buck. Remember when John Candy's telling this girl he's dating his 5-year plan to quit smoking? And he says, first year is cigarettes, and then I'm going to move to cigars. And then I'm going to get a pipe, and then I'm going to go to chewing tobacco, and then I'll be on nicotine gum, and then I'll quit. Now, it's pretty funny when he said it. But he's on to something. The way you get rid of one addiction is you get another one. Thomas Chalmers, who was one of the... He's widely held to be the greatest Scottish preacher of the 19th century. He was a really smart guy. Great preacher. He wrote books on political theory. Brilliant mind. And I want to get this quote right. This is what he said. He's a little smarter than Uncle Buck. He said, it is seldom that any of our tastes, bad habits or flaws, are made to disappear by a mere process of natural extinction. In other words, here's this brilliant Christian, this brilliant man. He said, all your problems in life very seldom go away by your own effort, by just saying, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to do it again. It's very seldom that this is done through the instrumentality of reasoning. You can't think your way out of it. It is almost never done by the mere force of mental determination. You can't say, I'll never do it again. You're not that strong. But what cannot be destroyed may be dispossessed. What you can't destroy, you can dispossess. There's not one transformation where the heart is left without an idol. Now get that. He said, everybody's going to worship something. Everybody's going to run to something. Remember David said, I'll go to the strong high tower? Everybody's going to run to something. Life's too tough. You're going to run to something. And what you run to is your idol. There's no transformation where the heart is left without an idol. You always have an idol. You are always worshiping something. You're always running to something. The heart's desire for one particular object may be conquered, but as to its desire for having some supreme object, that is unconquerable. Did you get that? He said, you'll always have an idol. You'll never fix that. You're always going to worship something. You'll always run to something. The only way to dispossess one affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. Now, Thomas Chalmers was a really smart guy. Let me give you a quote from a guy who is even smarter than Thomas Chalmers. Could you put that scripture up, gentlemen? This is Jesus Christ. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finds none. And then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Click. Then he goes and takes with him 7 other spirits more wicked than himself. They enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation. Now, that's a tough parable, and you could go a lot of different ways with it. But notice what Jesus is saying, and I think the principle will stand. He's saying if you get rid of one demon, if you get something out of your life, but you don't replace it, it'll come back stronger than it ever was before. So you just can't get it out. You've got to have something else come in. Something else has to capture your attention. You've got to get a new idol. You've got to get something else that you worship. There's got to be something else that comes into your life that you run to, and that is Jesus Christ. And the more that you fall in love with him, the more you see him high and lifted up in your life, the more you see his grace, the more you catch a vision of what he did for you on the cross, the more you catch a vision of the hope that he can baptize you in, the more that you can begin to grow in him. And listen to me, he is the most wonderful addiction, because while you may spiral downward with all the other addictions, you spiral upward with him. That's why I love Celebrate Recovery here. I started going to Celebrate Recovery because it's a pastoral thing. I got to show up, right? I'm the pastor. And it really helped that they had good food. That was great, you know. I was going once a month, and I think I've been the last 2 weeks and two of the last three or four. The food's great. The worship's powerful. I don't think there's any better worship in this county than what happens on Tuesday nights here. Tremendous worship. But essentially what Celebrate Recovery is, and I've read some of the material, but I've been there. Essentially what they do in Celebrate Recovery is for your, and by the way, Celebrate Recovery is for your habits, hang-ups, and hurts. Not in that order, but 3 H's. But what Celebrate Recovery gets is that all sin is an addiction. That's what Celebrate Recovery gets. And the worship is really all about Jesus. It's the most Christ-centered worship that you'll ever be a part of, because it's essentially a lot of people come together and not being in denial about their issues. So they sit around and they talk and they admit so that they're not in denial about their hang-ups. But then what they do is they work on their new addiction, which is Jesus. So they just get around and they sing and they praise Jesus for a while. They're basically exposing the old addiction and they're building a new addiction, which is Jesus Christ. That's really what Celebrate Recovery is about, from what I can gather. And it's a wonderful place to be. Listen to me. All sin is an addiction. Don't think it's about drugs and alcohol, maybe pornography. Everything's an addiction. The reason you can't break free from your anger is because you're addicted to it. The reason you can't break free from lying is because it's an addiction. It has a power over your life. It was crouching at the door, and its desire was for you, and it's got hold of you. Everything you've got is an addiction. Your unforgiveness is an addiction. And the only way you're going to break free is you're going to have to come to Jesus Christ, pray that he zaps you. I hope that he does. He can. But you're going to have to begin to build another addiction, because even if he zaps it all out of your life, if you don't put a greater addiction in its place, it's all going to come back anyway. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Jesus Christ. Will you stand with me? There's a guy named Alan Gardner who was a missionary, and he went into Africa in 1851, a long time ago. And he was a great man of God, and so he went in with this team, and what they wanted to do was minister in Africa. And they got in, and the natives stole most of their supplies, stole most of their food, and there was a boat that was supposed to come with new supplies, and it never showed up. So here are these men, these missionaries, and they're basically on the seashore waiting for a boat that is never going to show up, and they don't have food, and so basically one by one they're starving to death, just dying. The boat did show up, and all the men were dead, but from what they can figure, Alan Gardner was the last man to starve to death of that missionary group. But they had his journal, and he had been keeping his thoughts as he died a slow and painful death. And his last entry before he died was Psalms 34, verse 10. And it said, "Young lions do lack, and they suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing." And then the last thing that he wrote in his life was this line, "I am overwhelmed by a sense of the goodness of God." That's what addiction looks like. He was a man who had given his life to Jesus Christ. on a lonely beach surrounded by dead bodies, knowing that he himself would be next, is overwhelmed by God's grace in his life. That can be you. That can be me. And when we get to that place, the other stuff loses its power. And it's amazing that Peter, Paul, and John would start their letters by saying, I'm Peter, I'm Paul, I'm John. I'm a servant of Jesus. A slave of Jesus. I'm addicted to Jesus. And that's got to be the ultimate answer in dealing with all of your other addictions or sins. Maybe today there's something that is besetting you. You come and pray. Maybe today it's time for you just to come and say, I have neglected my relationship with you. And because of that, I've opened the door into all kinds of damaging things in my life. I've become a hurtful person. Let me see your beauty. May the train of your robe fill my life. May it fill this temple for me. Save me. Let me see you. Let me show yourself to me so that I can fall in love with you. You've got to be the vastly superior addiction in my life. It's a prayer that the Lord will answer. Maybe today you're struggling with something and nobody knows about it. You just want to come and pray. And let's not forget that this is the first week of 2016. And maybe there are a few of you who would just like to come and pray for this church that we please God this year. This church needs your prayer. This church can't go on without your prayer. If you've never prayed for this church, start now. Let's sing.